This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can... Hello?
Did you just knock that off? Are you there?
Yeah, no, it turned off on its own. Not sure why. Hold on one second.
Are we on?
I guess we're on without the music. I'm not sure why it got knocked off, but, you know, we can continue. Bum, 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 bum. Oh,
well,
this is Beat Your Genes podcast.
Complain to the management and IT people.
I am on it.
We pay a lot of money for those people, mate.
Oh, man. Yeah. Well, this is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I've created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. So how's that? I guess that's close enough.
That's very good. That's the best we've ever had it.
All right. Well, we continue this garage operation here at the Beat Your Genes podcast. Nate G here and Dr. Doug Lyle. Dr. Lyle, how are you doing this evening?
Good. Very well. How about yourself?
Doing very well. All right. So just in case that we've got some new listeners today, the intro got cut off. And so if in case you have some questions and you want to call in live to our show, we are live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. You can call in. The number is 657-383-0751. So that's if you want to call in live anytime during our show. Again, the number is 657-383-0751. So Dr. Lyle, today on our show, we're going to talk a little bit about internal audience with regards to some sports. We've got a question about nervousness while public speaking, a question about running experiments on lovers. That's a really interesting one. I like it. And then we've got a question from someone who's just gotten over a very tough breakup. I'm going to hit it and go right to it. You ready?
Very good. All right.
Fantastic. Dr. Lyle, in your best guess, did Lance Armstrong win over his internal audience? To this day, in interviews, he justifies his doping because everybody else was doing it. Of course, they were. Jose Canseco in baseball makes the same argument that you can give 100 ball players steroids, and even then they won't put in the work and then become the next Jose Canseco. Are these athletes winning over their internal audience, or do they feel like they cheated? Could they be so narcissistic that they have fully deceived themselves? Where do we draw the line at performance enhancing substances in the modern environment?
Kind of an interesting question. I would say that each of these people are individuals, and they've each got their own individual process that they're going through. Lance Armstrong, from what I can tell, is just an unbelievably narcissistic human, and just a seriously bad apple. And so I think that Lance Armstrong could justify just about anything. In terms of what goes on in the internal audience of a hyper disagreeable, person like that, I don't even know what goes on in there quite. In other words, if you think about a continuum, a bell curve of agreeable, disagreeable, and think of a person who's at the 99th percentile for disagreeable. So essentially, even if they are, let's suppose they've got enough conscientiousness that they are not in fact a sociopath, but they are pretty close. In other words, if we slide the conscientiousness scale down a little bit, there isn't a moment that we call it a sociopath or not a sociopath. It's a matter of degree. And so Lance Armstrong did many things that it would be reasonable to call sociopathic. And so it's clearly a haywire human that would not have lived in the Stone Age. In other words, he would have been the good old boy network in the Stone Age environment would have watched his nasty behavior, and they would have eventually taken him out. So that's why disagreeable behavior at that level is not typically, you know, it's not typical of human beings at this point in time. Now, undoubtedly, it was more typical of them 500,000 years ago. So essentially us against them, me against you, minimum of cooperation and just egregious self-interest. That is an essentially amoral behavior reminiscent of, you know, an animal predator. So the think about the similar question might be, what's the internal audience of a Charles Manson? Now obviously those two guys differ by essentially some kind of there's a divide. So Lance Armstrong isn't a Charles Manson, but it smells similar. It's they're cousins psychologically. So Armstrong had no compunction to do some of the rather amazing things that he did in pursuit of getting to the top of the dominance hierarchy. I don't think Canseco is, from what I can gather, I don't think Canseco's in the same league for being ruthless as an Armstrong. So the question about their internal audiences, I think, gets to be a little bizarre, because remember, your internal audience has an awful lot of your personality in it, since it's the same genes that built it. So Armstrong's internal internal audience is extremely self-serving in how it's going to observe everything. And so I have a feeling that he hasn't had much inner turmoil in how it is that he's behaved. Now, when it comes to our own, you know, place in anything like this, these are interesting problems, and everyone draws the line a little bit differently with respect to how it is that they manage competitive issues and what is cheating and what isn't cheating and how far do you take it. And all of us have been in dicey situations where we were not sure what is it that we should do. I would say that in general, the notion is that your default should be to do it right. And even if it's costly to you in some way that you can, you know, that you can manage, that you don't get suckered in by the notion that everyone, quote, else is doing it. Now, if you're trying to get out of a Nazi concentration camp and everybody is saying that they're not Jewish, then by all means, say that you're not Jewish, okay? There's a time and place when, you know, honesty is here to serve a purpose. But one of the important purposes is to be able to look yourself in the mirror and to feel like your achievements, you know, that your internal audience is respectful and admiring of how it is that you handled things. I look back in, I can't remember what Olympics it was. It might have been 1992. Might have been Atlanta. Yeah, or maybe that was 96, when Flora Griffiths Joyner was torching up the track. Those of us old enough to remember, FloJo was the hottest thing in those Olympics. She was beautiful. She was super fast, and she was beating everybody by a mile in the sprints. But she was cheating. And probably the most talented runner of that generation was Evelyn Ashford. And I'm sure to this day, Evelyn Ashford can look herself in the mirror and, you know, shrugs her shoulders. She did the very, very best she could. Somebody else cheated. And FloJo died as a result of some kind of liver cancer that is not surprising when you start using these kinds of things. So anyway, yeah, but do it right is the way to do it. And it's a Major League Baseball and the cycling world. This was a tough situation for, this is what happens when you don't have appropriate police forces. This reminds me of commerce in the third world, where you have changing regimes and changing rules. This is a big reason why India is a total mess in terms economically, because they changed the rules. And they change the rules constantly, and nobody has any consistency, et cetera. And so it's you wind up with a total political economic fiasco. This is why the United States is so successful and other countries, because despite all the vitriol that you'll get in the political scene, the rules stay almost identical from year to year. And therefore, people can settle in and play the game and compete with each other for selling shoes and socks, you know, on a playing field that makes some sense. The so it was very exciting for baseball. They knew damn well these guys were dirty. And so did Barry Bonds as he watched people outstrip him when he was massively superior to them. So he decided he better juice himself up or he was going to be left behind. That was a mistake. And that was he should not have done that. He should have avoided the temptation and simply pull an Evelyn Ashford and do it right, no matter what the consequences are. And then he wouldn't have the trash of a career that he now has as everybody looks back on him. So, yeah, when everybody else cheats, you just do it right, unless there's something on the line that you cannot afford, okay? Jose Canseco had enough talent. He could have been an excellent major league hitter, and he was a legitimate major leaguer, and he should have left it at that. Mark McGwire also now lives in infamy, will never go into the Hall of Fame, even though he was the first man to break Babe Ruth's record or Roger Maris's record. The no, now he's in infamy. So is Sammy Sosa, okay? So is Barry Bonds. This is – we point at these guys when really it was the police force, it was Major League Baseball, that stuck their heads in the sand and allowed this fiasco to happen. It was so bad that they finally cleaned up their act. I don't particularly blame these people, except they made poor choices. When I think that these were 30-year-old young men full of testosterone, and you know, now that I'm pushing 60, 30 years old, they seem like children to me. They're grown men and they're making grown man decisions, but they're not very grown up, and they're not very smart, and they're not very wise, and they're under a phenomenal amount of pressure, and they make mistakes. So they did, and they have to live with those consequences. But for us, I would say that in general, as you look at your world, whenever you're in these situations, play it straight, and unless there's something outrageously important that you cannot live without reasonably, and everyone else quote is cheating, then you have to weigh that cost benefit. Let's hope that you're never in those circumstances.
Excellent, Dr. Lyle. Now, my position has always been that if they're going to make steroids illegal for athletes, they should make Photoshop illegal for models. What do you think about that?
Now, that's interesting. I had never thought about that. I don't think I think quite the same, but that's all right. On we go.
Well, okay. Yeah, I was just, yeah, that's a joke, honestly. You know, I'm agreeing with you.
Yeah.
But I'm thinking, you know, in the competitive arena of mm-hmm. sports, that's the mm-hmm. the enhancer is steroids. Whereas with beauty, mm-hmm. The enhancer is now Photoshop. You know, they're not really,
right.
You know, I guess you can consider breast enhancements and plastic surgery the steroid of the model world.
Yeah.
But
sure.
But, you know, does that mean that a model should eschew from, you know, Photoshop or those types of other things?
No, I don't think so. In other words, that's a whole different issue. In those kinds of situations, we don't have, you know, objective records involved. We don't have the fact that other people would have to do essentially potentially lethal harm to themselves in order to compete. Also, the competitive hierarchy is so different. It's not nearly so narrow. This is a whole different kettle of fish. I feel like if someone wants to do all kinds of things to their body at the hands of a plastic surgeon in order to be a little bit more competitive for a very short period of time, you know, it's not quite the same thing as putting drugs inside your system that are unbelievably dangerous. And so, and then having an entire hierarchy of super high pay and enormous differences in that pay, depending upon whether you hit 20 home runs or whether you hit 14. And that models don't face that. The and Photoshop certainly isn't doing anybody any harm, other than the competitive periodical or website that's trying to get more eyeballs on the thing. So nobody's being harmed by that, other than we're living in a silly world of you know, supernormal stimuli. But that's not a crisis, and it's not even a crisis when some model, you know, or any other individual has a bunch of plastic surgery. This is a very private thing that isn't directly causing another individual to wind up being in an impossible competitive situation. That's not what's happening there. That's a personal decision about what that specific individual wants to do, and it's guaranteeing them nothing. Whereas when you have a closed system of elite athletes competing for huge contracts, lifetime changing monetary issues, and the differences is clear that the differences the differences in performance enhancing drugs can make a huge difference in a person's monetary, the difference between not being in the major leagues and making $10 million a year. There is no plastic surgery or drug or anything else that any model could ever take that would have that kind of an impact. And so the whole thing is I see there's superficial similarities, but it's not even close to the same contest and same issues. These performance enhancing drugs, I think, are I haven't seen data on this, but I fully expect that they have pretty radical major long term consequences for many people. And so to have a system set up where we are aware that these self-damaging products are definitely useful in the competitive sphere, and we put people in a position that if they don't use them, that are a competitive disadvantage for, you know, these elite spots, I think that's a huge mistake. And I don't think it's the same game as whether or not you take a chance on a plastic surgeon. I think it's quite different.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that makes sense. That makes sense. With an internal audience of a model who, say, got rich and famous from using a lot of these, you know, would her internal audience be as impressed with herself, do you think?
Oh, God knows what goes on there. I mean, I think that's such a highly individual thing. I think that that's a... That is a bizarre and difficult business to be in, obviously. It's generally short-term, short-run, very young people, the ultimate of superficiality and subjectivity. This is not parking a bunch of home runs over the fence. This is, you know, you getting picked and 177 other women that are equally attractive to you not getting picked, and you getting a big contract and none of them getting anything. That's so who the hell is going to take their chances on some plastic surgeon, you know, going after your eyebrows with that? Good luck to you. How the hell do you know that that's going to make a difference? So this is that's more like, you know, those are lottery tickets and spinning the wheel, the and bizarre anyway. So, yeah, I don't know about the internal audience of models. I don't think it would. That's such a haywire situation. And such a bizarre world to live in that I don't know that it would particularly bother any model if she managed to win the game by using plastic surgery. I don't think the notion is that you're supposed to win it fair. I think it's that's the ultimate of the Oakland Raiders. Just win, baby. Whoever you have to sleep with and however you have to sleep with them, that's how you get that job.
Fantastic. All right. Our next question, Dr. Lyle. I teach workshops and give speeches at my job, and even though I've done it for 20 years, I still spend way too much energy. I'm always well prepared, and I get 95% positive feedback. I know I'm a good teacher, and I should feel safe. But why on earth does my nervous system overreact as if I was in danger? Nobody would know this since I seem very self-confident. But my hands and feet get cold, and I get the nervous sweat and have to dress to cover that up. What can I do to beat my genes and calm down? And by the way, I'm healthy and not overweight.
Well, there's a let's back the camera up and look at this thing from the 10,000 foot view. Any psychological experience that a person is having is the result of two factors. Those factors are either genetic or they're environmental. So in fact, what they are is they're environmental inputs acting on genetically built neural circuits. So a highly anxious presenter has two factors that could be the result in the unpleasant process. One of them is genetic. In other words, they're just simply super conscientious, high strung, and therefore have a lot of anxiety. And particularly in that particular circumstance of presenting, which is generally a highly anxious thing for most people. The other issue could be environmental. So let's look at what I mean by environmental. I mean, we already know we've got a nervous system that is high strung in this regard. This is obvious. So if the person has been doing this for a long time and they have a great deal of evidence that they're competent and they're not going to lay an egg and they are well prepared consistently, then we already know we've got a hyper conscientious nervous system that sits on a great deal of anxiety. So the question is, what can we do? We can't change that nervous system. The genes are off the table. And we already know that the genes are fundamentally responsible for what we are observing. So the question is, can we do something to the environmental inputs that would impact how this nervous system would be reacting? Now, the first thing, so the person reasonably is saying, hey, I'm a really good presenter. I do it over and over again. I keep getting good results. Why the hell am I so anxious? And what can I do about it? Well, the first thing is that the anticipation of the feedback from the audience isn't the only environmental factor that's in the game here. What's in the game also is the person's finances. So we have to look down through their down arrow that's actually taking place inside of their mind and discover where the worst case scenario is. So you can imagine that the person may not have actually thought through, well, what will happen if it goes south? What will happen if I don't do so well, or I do particularly poorly, where there's a decision maker in the audience or there's a monitoring of me, and it turns out that I get cut loose from a lot of my income? Am I in fact secure? And do I have other skills or other venues by which I could still make a good living? I would want to know, is that nervous system sitting in a position of power where they've thought through the worst case scenario very carefully and they've figured out how it is that they are going to manage it if the worst case scenario happens? So that would be one thing that I would recommend that they would do. So if they would talk to me and I was their therapist, I would be very carefully walking them down through the very worst case scenario. And the worst case scenario is not being embarrassed in front of a crowd. It's in fact quelli of being embarrassed in front of a crowd and in fact having everything go to shit as a result of that. So that can be driving not having processed that and be thinking through how one would manage the worst case scenario can be adding or keeping an extra set of anxiety in that system. So that's one thing we would do. The other thing that I would do, I would have a couple of techniques. As a speaker myself, there's a couple of useful techniques that are worth knowing. And that is that if you're very anxious about anything, your wedding, you know what I mean, your mother-in-law's visiting and you're going to cook her dinner, whatever, a useful thing to do is to drain off adrenaline. So when the person's talking about their hands and feet getting cold or whatever it is, we're looking at adrenaline processes, obviously. And so what these are is these are Stone Age mechanisms to help you deal with predator challenges. And so you can sit right there in a bath of adrenaline. And what the nervous system effectively is doing is it's sitting with it's got one foot on the gas and one foot on the brake. And the brake is actually heavier than the gas, because when you're in a predator-prey crisis, you actually don't want to move. So you are feeling frozen, and you don't want to do much movement. you're attempting to maintain silence. And so you're actually trying to be quiet and still to not be noticed. Now, once you start moving your large muscles, your Stone Age brain infers that you are, in fact, in an all-out run for your life. So the predator can hear you snapping twigs as you run through the bushes. And so you're either going to survive or you're not going to survive. And this is all going to be over in a minute or less, probably about 30 seconds. So what I would recommend a speaker to do is to get themselves in a position before they speak where they jog in place. And they jog in place repeatedly and, in fact, give themselves a good workout for about 10 or 15 minutes. Because if they jog in place, get tired, catch their breath, jog in place, get tired, catch their breath, jog in place, get tired, catch their breath, you keep doing this. And what's happening is you're draining the adrenaline down. You're actually utilizing the adrenaline. And the fact that you are not, in fact, being torn apart by a predator as a result of this causes the Stone Age brain to make inferences that we have survived now that we have taken our foot off the brake and put it on the gas and started large muscular movements that are noisy. We now are aware that we have survived the crisis. And when you've survived the crisis, the adrenaline starts to get dialed down. In other words, the brain is a redundant, recursive, eavesdropping device. And so as it notices, parts of the brain notice that we have not been eaten by a predator, even though we were full of adrenaline and therefore in a predator-prey crisis. Now we have drained that adrenaline off. We are breathing hard. We've used the big muscles, and therefore we've survived. Therefore, there's no reason to keep turning on the adrenaline high. Okay? And so at that point, we should find the anxiety to be significantly reduced. So that's another thing that I would do. Another thing that you can do is a speaking technique that can be useful is to most speakers, in fact, almost all speakers, will go out on stage and they attempt to earn status from the audience. This is a mistake. What you want to do is you want to go out there and lose status with the audience because that's your worst case scenario. The audience is naturally braced against giving you status. They're there, they're ready to listen, but they essentially, to some degree, have their arms folded. In other words, they're essentially defending against your earning of your status. You're going up in front of them as if you're on the balcony looking down at them. You have been granted the title of the head of the village. And there can be moderate resentment in the unconscious processes of an audience, certainly in many members of the audience about this. So what we want to do is we want to diffuse this as quickly as possible. So one of the smart things that you can do is to begin any presentation with a self-effacing process. So you think through what that self-effacing process can be. So you can look at the work that I do. If you look at my little 17-minute TED Talk that I do on the Pleasure Trap, I always come out with an opening where I am self-effacing. Yeah, that's not an accident. That's a very careful part of speaking that basically causes the entire audience to say, all right, this guy's not full of himself. He's not declaring himself the top man in the room. He's not declaring himself that he should be the head of the balcony. He's totally cool, and he doesn't see himself as above us. That is the plan. And so if you use that plan, if you organize a way to do it, is foolproof. It cannot miss. That's because it is, in fact, the source code. It's getting down into the source code of the problem. The problem is with an audience, do they feel like, you know, do they like you? Well, if they feel like you're above them talking down, that's your biggest threat. That's where it goes wrong. So instead, what we're going to do is we're going to make damn sure that we don't come across with that. Now, if you're a good speaker and a good presenter and you do not come across as full of yourself, you're going to be fine. And this person's been fine their whole career. And that's because they have not screwed it up. But we can actually do one notch better than that. So you've gone up there and done excellent presentations because you're well prepared, and people, you know, concede after 5 or 10 minutes that, yeah, you deserve the balcony, and okay, it's all fine, and this person's a good speaker, and okay, it's fine. But you might live with the anxiety of not being sure that it's going to work, okay? Whereas if you have a technique of self-effacing process in the first minute, you will soon find out that it always works. And it always works better than anything else that you can do. And that tells you that you are speaking right to the source code of the audience, that they are relieved that you are not full of yourself. Okay? And so now you can instantly get that feeling. That's what we call rapport. Okay? So that's something for this person to consider. And just for anybody out there that ever does presentations in general, that's a useful thing to know about what's going on between performer and audience. The finally, a thing that I would say that occurs to me is this person saying that they over-prepare. So, of course they do. They're a hyper-conscientious nutcase, and so they're over-preparing. So one of the things that we can do is we can run a series of experiments. And the series of experiments would be to essentially plan to prepare, you know, 10% less. And we're going to do that a few times. And we're going to see whether or not it costs us anything. And then we're going to prepare 10% less after that. And we're going to, if a person gives a lot of presentations, if this is a consistent thing they do for a career, we can walk this down to where we learn by experience that in fact we can spend half the time preparing that we're preparing. And we're going to be fine. But we don't take a big chance. Never make a big decision when a small decision will do. Make a 10% difference first and then walk it down. And we might find that, you know, 6 months from now, we're doing half as much prepping, but we've convinced ourselves in a process of successive approximation experiments that we're fine. So those are the ideas that I would give this person, and hopefully some of them, those ideas will be useful for them and useful for others.
Dr. Lyle, that's fantastic. I love that. I have shared many of those tips with other people with your talk on the pleasure trap.
Mm-hmm.
And I always wonder too, if when you come out, you kind of rub your hand, and I wonder if that's also a technique. When I'm sounding like a stalker here, I've like paid attention to every little detail.
No,
so I always wonder if that was like on purpose.
Part of my goofy personality. But I'm actually intending to show people that I'm goofy, okay? And I am goofy. And so I want them to know that I'm goofy. And so that in doing so, that's part of an honest presentation. But look, I'm not up here to talk down. I'm just a goofy guy, but I got some ideas to share with you. And that's where we go with that. Yeah, but the rubbing my hands, that's right. I forgot about that. That's not an intentional thing. That's just goofus.
All right. Our next question is a very peculiar question by a listener of ours who enjoys running evolutionary psychology experiments in his life. Mm-hmm. Dr. Mm-hmm. Lyle, one thing that baffles me is when I tell my girlfriends, it gets plural, when I tell my girlfriends mm-hmm. that I love them, kiss them, hug them, and do other displays of affection, their response degrades to rather cold within days. They rarely spontaneously reciprocate physical affection. Yet, if I turn cold for a few days and have the you are like dirt mentality, then suddenly I get hugs, kisses, sexual massages, and other displays of affection. I'm rougher in bed as well, doing what I want with little regard for whether she enjoys it. It does not make sense, but these women liven up in bed as well and actually tell me that they like it more. How do I balance displays of affection to a woman without eliciting this kind of cold, you value me, so I'm better than you type of response? I'd like a positive esteem dynamic both ways. It's almost like I lose both ways, either to cold responses or to the bitterness I have to cultivate, pull this off.
All right. this reminds me of things that you'll hear from time to time. You say, gosh, people from Atlanta, they're like this. They always like this, and this is how they are. Or people from Boston, this is how they are. It's like, no, I've actually been to both those places, and, quote, people from Boston aren't in a particular way, and people from Atlanta aren't in a particular way. There are got different accents, and maybe some mild cultural differences that you can pick up on, but the effect sizes are tiny compared to the individual variation within the individuals. So there's a hell of a lot more variation between 30 people in Boston than there are in the personalities of the different sectors of the United States generally. The i.e., people from L.A. aren't any particular way. There's 8 million or 10 million individuals, and they're all different. Now, so this is an example of an overgeneralization. So the individual has a small N. He's probably talking about less than 3 people. And he has not actually observed over the course of, quote, a set of experiments of 20 of these people. He has not, in fact, observed a correlation coefficient at all. He's observed probably in a single individual a process that has puzzled him, and therefore the answer is in the specific personality of the individual that's on the other end of this, not on a general process of human females in relationships. Okay? So I think we can back up the camera and really see what the question is. Is it true that if you treat females like shit and are completely unresponsive and don't care about what their sexual results are when you're having sex with them, and you're essentially an ass, that they are super affectionate and love you more? Answer, not true. Okay? That is not a universal characteristic feature of the female brain. Now, could it be characteristic of an individual female in a particular ecological context? Yes, it could be. So, for example, if a female is not so sure that the guy's really that worth it, that he's maybe not cool enough for her, and then maybe she's got a particular personality that likes people that are rougher and rougher edge and more disagreeable, and this guy's on the line for being too agreeable, and now he starts acting disagreeable and now makes her feel like she's in better circumstances and she's all into it. Of course, very possible. This is the individual differences in female psychology. So the same thing could be true. Let's turn the camera around and let's see what it looks like from the other end. So let's suppose there's a bunch of men and these guys are individually different. And a female is asking the question. Like, one guy wants to be tied up and whipped. Okay, another guy wants to pretend that he's the sultan and you're serving him. Look at how different they are. So a woman on the other side could say, why is it I've had these guys and I've run experiments that when I tie them up or I try to tie them up and whip them, you know, they really like it. And then when I'm nice, they're not. It's like, no, you just had some weirdos. So the answer to the question is, this is not a species-wide phenomenon. The experiment, quote, hasn't been run. It's been a very small and little individual issue that's nothing more than anecdotal. And the answer to the problem that this young man is seeking, which is a person that he can be himself with, and that person likes just who he is as he expresses affection and has a relationship and expresses his appreciation in the way that he would like to, the answer is find the girl that fits. Okay? That is the answer to the mystery. And if you are acting out a different personality and it's working with a given female, it means you got the wrong female for you. That's all.
Fascinating, Dr. Lyle. I love this.
All right.
Yeah, it kind of seems a little bit from the world of the pickup artists and things like that. So,
uh-huh.
All right, Dr. Lyle, our next
right.
question is about getting over a breakup. Dr. Lyle, almost 3 years ago, my boyfriend of 9 years broke up with me.
Mm-hmm.
He said that what we have is not enough for him, and he's not in love with me anymore. The truth
mm-hmm.
is that we've been having some problems for 6 months and had discussed the possibility of breaking up. Both of us felt attached to each other, though, and did not want to lose each other. But still, something felt wrong for both of us, and we kept behaving a bit nasty to each other. He went ahead first and asked to break up, and I was totally not ready for it. I don't think I'm in love with him, but I miss him, and I can't imagine life without him. We've met twice these past two and a half weeks, and both times he said that he loves me and kept showering me with compliments. We ended up having sex, not the tender and sweet kind, more of the hot, carnal kind. It was not planned, and we tried to withhold for as long as we could, but caved in the end. My question is, given that we have sexual desire for each other and we care about each other, what is the best way forward for us, or rather for me? There's no getting back together from his side, at least, and I don't think I would want that either. I miss him so much, though, and everything reminds me of him. I don't think I can go cold turkey, especially when he's so responsive and says he loves me and tries to make me feel happy. It's rather messy, I know, but 9 years is a long time, 8 of them quite happy. I don't know how to proceed, and I'm afraid without him for some reason. I'm scared that I won't be able to fall in love ever again. On the other hand, it's heartbreaking just for two, he may be with someone else. Should I stay in contact with him, or should I suffer alone and cut him out of my life completely?
All right. Well, unfortunately, we probably don't have the most important piece of data that we need to answer this question. And the most important piece of data we need is, how old are you and do you want to have kids? Without that question, I can't give this person the answer that I would give them. If the answer is, I really want to have kids, then the answer is get the hell out, okay? And because this is not Mr. Right. If the answer is I don't want to have kids, or it's not very important to me, then the answer is, well, no problem. You just play it out, and you haven't had enough sand kicked in your face yet, but you will. It's on its way. You've had 6 months of sand kicked in your face, and you need a little more sand kicked in your face. If a guy says, you know, this is not enough, I'm not in love with you, he's kind of run the CB, and this is not, you know, a great place. So the fact that you have to consider that there's going to be essentially a continuum of qualification. So it isn't that you qualify or don't qualify. You clearly qualify for casual mating strategy. So, but the question is, do you qualify for him to be at peace with the concept of pair bond strategy, i.e. that you're the best deal that he thinks he's going to get in the intermediate to long-term future? And the answer is no, that's not what he thinks right now. So kind of what you are is a casual mating strategy / plan B. Now, that's a hard place to be if you're a female. And a woman. And so this is, and I would again say that nobody can, this is sort of a right brain problem. We're not going to analyze this and sell you on a solution to a right brain problem. You're going to feel your way to this one. And you've got some more feeling to do. But the handwriting's on the wall, and I think that these things sort of settle themselves. In the long run, meaning the next few months. However, if you're under the gun for time, you're 36 and you really want to have children, and this was the guy, and you're 9 years in, you've been with him since you were 27, and you thought this was it. You thought this was going to be your husband and the father of your kids and your lifetime partner, and he's telling you you don't qualify, then you need to get out. Okay, that's what I would recommend that you do. But it depends upon how important those goals are to you. A mistake would be to fight for that individual and try to grab a hold of them, get yourself pregnant, and then hang on. You know, trust me, I've seen it with people close to me. I've had friends of mine that pulled that stunt. And what they got was they got 30 years of mediocrity is what they got. They got what they deserved. So don't do that to yourself. So that's a mistake. That's a waste of life. So instead, that's the question that I would have this woman answer first to herself. Where do you stand with respect to kids? If it's an important issue and you're getting up against the clock, i.e. you're 34. If you're 34 years old, you're up against the clock. You're 32, you can afford to burn another 6 months and sort of let this play its way. If you're 34, you better be ready to move on and understand that this is a fundamentally deficient relationship, and that trying to morph this thing into more than it is, you know, could be very expensive. Could be the time you needed to be on the market to actually find someone for whom you actually qualify. And before you have children with anybody, unless you're independently wealthy and a real free spirit or some such thing, you want to really qualify. You want to really know that you qualify. You want to have had quite a bit of track record with the individual. You want to be certain, because if you're going to take that journey, you want to take it with someone outstanding who is really into you.
Dr. Lyle, fascinating. And this listener emailed us, this was April of last year, so we apologize mm-hmm. for taking so long to get these questions, and hopefully some of these situations have been sorted out. You know, if this listener gives us a call and updates us or sends me an email at beatyourgenes@gmail.com, give us an update and see how things are going. And hopefully this answer from Dr. Lyle helped a great deal. Dr. Lyle, we're going to end the show now. And any final thoughts?
Oh, terrific. Great. Let's get the music on next week.
I know, because then I'm just going to have to sing a karaoke.
That's right. You got it.
All right, Dr. Lyle, thanks very much. We'll have a great evening, and we'll talk to you next week.
Very good.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world. Oh, good. It finally played.
All right. Fantastic.